Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Hello and welcome to What's the Crack? I'm joined here with Dan Werb. Dan, could you give me an explanation of what your title is and what you do?
Sure. I'm the director of the International Center for Science and Drug Policy, and I'm also affiliated with the St. Michael's Hospital in Toronto, which is a research institute, and the University of California, San Diego, where I'm on faculty in the Division of Infectious Diseases and Global Public Health.
Can you talk us through some of the work that you've done recently with this institute?
Sure. So I do two things, mainly. I work on drug policy on the one hand, and then I work on epidemiology of substance use, mostly focused on injection drug use on the other. Of course, there's lots and lots of overlap. When you start looking at one, you start looking at the other. Those are sort of the two domains of my work. With the International Center for Science and Drug Policy, the focus of the work has really been on communicating the scientific evidence around the impacts of drug policy, and doing that in as creative ways as we possibly can. Sometimes that means undertaking a systematic review or meta-analysis to get at the heart of what the scientific evidence actually says about a question. And sometimes that means engaging directly with policymakers or other stakeholders to make sure that if there is evidence that exists, that it is presented to them in a way that they can appreciate.
Great. And with the International Center of Science...
We can call it the ICSDP.
ICSDP, that's perfect for me. Is it a group of just scientists or is it also policymakers? Is it a range of different people that are joined in this?
So we have a scientific board that is made up of these very august global experts in a bunch of disciplines that sort of touch on drug policy, in criminology, epidemiology, some neurologists. And we don't have any policymakers within our own group, although some academics move on to policymaking and then move back and vice versa. Yeah. But we do have, through our extensive network, which is global in a lot of ways, we do have pretty good access to policymakers in a bunch of different places.
Great. As I guess more broadly, what do you think is the most pressing drug problem that you're dealing with at the moment?
Well, it depends on where you are situation or geographically. In North America, it's absolutely the massive increase in overdose deaths. Getting to the heart of why that's occurred and trying to determine ways to prevent it from continuing is the biggest issue here. And while we do try to be global, we're often influenced by what's happening close to us. Here we are in Toronto and Canada is experiencing this problem. So, we get motivated to look into it. I would say globally, it's difficult to maintain enthusiasm sometimes, but because there is such a deadlock when you look at drug policy, there's this emerging cadre of countries that want to more fully embrace or at least explore less criminalized policies that are moving away from criminalization, be that just decriminalization or regulation or even scaling up public health interventions within a more broad criminalization structure. But on the other hand, there are countries like Indonesia, the Philippines, Thailand, Russia, that are basically mired in and totally committed to policies that are super detrimental for a number of different reasons, and that really rely on enforcement, sometimes military force, brute force, extrajudicial killings. In the case of the Philippines right now.
Yeah, I was going to say that was quite recently in the media, wasn't it?
Well, yeah, and it's continuing. Mm-hmm. And the concern there is, like so many things, so many different sectors, there's a point at which evidence doesn't matter. And so when you talk about urgency, it's tough because it's an urgent problem, but it's one that, you know, the solutions are extremely limited.
Would you say that you said with Canada, it being mainly the overdose situation at the moment, is that currently not masking, but being still predominant over, say, the cannabis legalization that's happening now? I remember seeing, I think it was with an interview with Justin Trudeau, when they were talking about cannabis legalization, and then someone put their hand up and said, yeah, but you're forgetting about this opioid crisis that's happening. Would you say that it is kind of over and above the cannabis legalization situation? Or,
you know, it's interesting. I think the government invested a lot. So the federal government, mm-hmm. here I'm talking about in Canada, invested a lot of time and resources and manpower into establishing this process of bringing cannabis legalization forward. Mm-hmm. They came in. It was a key political promise. And they had a deadline of doing it, and they wanted to stick to that deadline because of the nature of the political cycle. And so up front, you saw lots and lots of government resources. And here, you know, I mean like staff in government agencies, in the federal government, being seconded to work on the issue of cannabis legalization. We had the Federal Task Force on Cannabis Regulation and Legalization struck. There was this process of consultation, and that cycle ended, and near the end of that cycle. And so that cycle ended, and with it, the federal government's responsibility, I think actually they could move that on to the provinces and territories, mm-hmm. right? So the federal government set its framework. Now it's up to the provinces and territories to work within that framework to set up their infrastructure. So in a way, I think that might have freed up resources from the government to then focus on the opioid overdose crisis. And this is not like they were doing one thing and they were doing another, but I think at least I observed as an outsider with some vantage point that, you know, increasingly we're seeing from the federal government a more clear focus on opioid overdose response.
Okay.
It's not like one wasn't there and then it was and the other disappeared, but there's a very clear shift in, at least at the federal level, yeah, that their interest has shifted to tackling the overdose crisis.
Great. And I believe that you are the principal investigator of PRIMA, which is a study looking at injecting drug use. Could you talk a bit more about that?
Yeah, absolutely. So I was motivated with this study by looking at injection drug use and all the sort of potential risks that people face when they start to inject, many of which I will caveat are amplified at the very least by the policies of criminalization that in fact place people at greater risk than the drug use would in and of itself. So you think about injection drug use within the context of criminalization, there are very good and rational reasons why someone who injects drugs would not carry their own syringes, because that would place them at risk of arrest, then they would go to prison. And so the sort of more abstract risk of sharing a syringe with someone and being infected with HIV as a result might go down on the sort of hierarchy of risks that they're avoiding. So looking at injection drug use and the fact that, yes, it is associated with risks such as overdose, such as bloodborne disease transmission, not only HIV, but hepatitis C is, you know, much more virulent than HIV, much more easily transferred through injection than HIV. And the limits of current disease prevention and overdose prevention efforts. So you can't, it's very difficult to reduce all the risks associated with injecting to zero, particularly, again, within a context of criminalization. But what you could do is eliminate those risks if you were able to eliminate people transitioning from non-injection drug use to injection drug use. Now, to date, the evidence on interventions that can actually do that is super limited. We did a systematic review a couple years ago and found that there had only ever been 8 studies evaluating interventions to prevent injection drug use. Mm-hmm. All of those were behavioral interventions. Only 4 of those evaluations found that there were any positive impacts. And to date, none have been brought to scale. So in terms of the, you know, it's funny because I think we all just assume that injection drug use, because of its many public health implications, is front and center in terms of the government response to preventing drugs. But in actual fact, that is absolutely not the case. There is no scaled up and effective policy to prevent people from transitioning from injection or from non-injection into injection drug use.
And surely they're a very hard to reach population going from that stage anyway, because it's a, I don't know, I'd say it was a very vulnerable time going from one to the other.
Absolutely.
And a very time sensitive as well.
Yes.
Because, yeah.
Yeah, I think you've hit the nail on the head. It's really difficult to, because the pool of people who are at risk of initiating injection drug use is so large, it's very difficult to create programming or tailor interventions to prevent that transition from that side. But what we do know is that people who already inject drugs often play a critical role in initiating others into this injection drug use process. It's not to say that people seek out others because they want to initiate them. Sometimes, yes, initiation events are motivated on the side of the initiator. They can reflect often gendered power dynamics and intimate partnerships. But the majority of what we're seeing from the data is that it's really people who are highly motivated because they've observed injection drug use practices. They've seen positive results from people who they know who have recently initiated, and they would like also to be initiated. So the motivation is often from people who are seeking to be initiated, people who haven't yet started. Whatever the case may be, wherever the motivation may lie, people who inject drugs, who have already started, play this critical role in introducing others. Now, we have better programming for people who inject drugs than we do for the sort of vulnerable and, as you say, hard to reach and even hard to define population of people who are at risk of starting. So what we're doing is we're focusing on that population of people who inject drugs, which is a known population, and trying to determine what makes them more or less likely to initiate others into injection drug use. And by doing that, seek to disrupt that phenomenon of people being initiated into injecting. And while the interventions to date have really focused on behavioral approaches, so trying to build resilience in people who inject drugs to make sure that they can avoid those settings, so that they can avoid saying yes to initiating others, I would argue that those are potentially quite limited, given that when you find yourself in a situation where someone has asked you to inject them for the first time, and you say no, they may say, well, I'll just go to someone else. And in fact, you know that person. And you know that they're not to be trusted, or you know that they don't know how to inject properly, or you know that they're not always careful with using clean syringes, or they're, you know, there's something that may place this person at danger. You may have a very good and rational reason to say yes to initiating someone else. Maybe it's a way to protect them from the unknown, the greater unknown out there. Maybe you think, well, they're so highly motivated, they're going to do it anyway. So at least I can teach them how to do it safely. So I would argue that if we're intervening or seeking to intervene on the moment when people are being asked to initiate others, we're intervening too late. So, you know, I guess I'm sort of crawling up the causal pathway, right? So from trying to prevent overdose and infectious disease transmission after people inject to try to prevent it through preventing the injection in and of itself, then moving from initiating or intervening on the initiation event itself to intervening to actually prevent that moment of initiating from happening in the first place, or that moment of potential initiation. In any case, one thing that I've been looking at is, again, to try to prevent these moments where people are being asked to initiate others, to try to prevent those moments entirely. Because I think within those moments, there's no good option. You either initiate someone, which isn't something that people generally like to do, or you don't, in which case maybe they're going to go to someone else and you potentially put them at greater danger. So how could we avoid those situations entirely? Well, my hypothesis and what I would suggest is that we can do that through structural intervention, through modifying the environment within which people live, within which people find themselves, and within which people use drugs. So to give you an example, if people, as I mentioned, talking about medication-assisted treatment, if people have opioid use disorders and they are managed appropriately through medication-assisted treatment like methadone or buprenorphine or even prescription heroin, diacetylmorphine, if people are able to manage their drug use, they are likely going to be less likely to be injecting drug use generally. Like the frequency of their injecting is likely going to reduce or even cease. So if someone's frequency of injection is reduced, then the amount that they expose others to injection drug use practices is necessarily going to reduce as well, if not go to zero. And then the normalizing of injecting that they're doing for others who may be at risk of starting, that process is going to end. We saw this, I think, this is my theory, is that we saw this in Switzerland. We saw after, this is, again, just a theory that I've developed based on the data coming out of Switzerland. But when Switzerland scaled up supervised injection facilities, medication-assisted treatment, needle and syringe programs, basically a public health harm reduction-oriented drug policy in 1993, and did so across the country, the proportion of people who inject drugs who reported recently starting to inject dropped from 20% to 3% within 7 years. Wow. And has been sustained at that low level. The annual incidence of people initiating injecting dropped from about 850 per year in 1993 to under 50 and has remained there. So there's something about what Switzerland did that weakened this process of initiating that I believe is driven, or I mean, the evidence demonstrates, the scientific evidence out there demonstrates, is often driven through this exposure piece, right? Mm-hmm. This exposure to injection piece.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Now, what we're finding with the data that we're collecting in PRIMER, which is a multi-site, multi-cohort study of people who inject drugs, looking specifically at their experiences initiating others. What we found is that people who are enrolled in medication-assisted treatment, they have about 50% less lower odds of initiating others into injection drug use compared to people who aren't on methadone. Now, to me, that's super compelling. That suggests, while at this stage it's an observational association, we can't assume causality one way or the other, but I think that there's enough there to at least pursue it further. And it makes plausible sense that if someone is retained in treatment, then they're injecting less, then they're going to be interacting with people who are potentially not yet injecting but might be at risk less within drug use settings, and they may be asked to inject other people less frequently, and therefore less likely to be initiating others. So that's what I'm pursuing right now, and we're looking not only at medication-assisted treatment, but also the potential impact of supervised injection facility use, housing status, and other factors like how gender or migration or deportation or injecting in public settings, how all these factors influence people's risk of initiating others.
That's really interesting. I saw that you were doing it in Vancouver, San Diego, Tijuana, and is it two in France?
Four sites in France. Yeah, so Paris, yeah. Strasbourg, Marseille, and Bordeaux.
Okay. I was just wondering why those sites were chosen in the four different countries.
So part of it is totally opportunistic.
Right.
I put this together when I was a postdoctoral student and was like, where do I know people who might be willing to introduce survey items into their cohort questionnaires? Mm-hmm. But part of it also reflected my interest in, well, it's an acknowledgement of the fact that epidemics of any kind are driven by local dynamics. So the way that an HIV epidemic moves among a certain population in one setting is going to be different than how it moves through another setting. There are always similarities. We can always pull factors that seem to be driving risk. But there are really important situational differences that we need to address. And when you think about Vancouver, San Diego, and Tijuana, those are really interesting settings for a number, or really interesting and distinct settings for a number of reasons. Tijuana is an under-resourced setting in a middle-income country. San Diego is a setting where access to medication-assisted treatment is really low. Vancouver is a setting where there's an extremely dense population of people who inject drugs in one 16-square block area of the city, but where access to low-threshold medication-assisted treatment is really high. Mm-hmm. Vancouver, unlike those other settings, has a supervised injection facility. France has extremely high coverage of medication-assisted treatment, whereas it was estimated a few years ago that coverage for people who were eligible for medication-assisted treatment in the U.S. was around 8%. In France, it's closer to 80%. So there's real important differences that might influence how what I would describe as epidemics of injection drug use move through a population.
And you know, this is on about injecting drug use. Is it specific to opioids, or can it be a crystal methamphetamine, or is it cocaine and heroin? Is it any drug that is injected, or is it specific to opioids?
Yeah, so we're looking at all drugs.
Right.
Okay. It's really the process of initiation into this form of this mode of consumption. Mm-hmm. That being said, medication-assisted treatment is only currently available for opioids.
Yep.
So heroin and related opioids. This is not a study or a line of investigation that's really focused on the impact of a particular drug. We're looking at a behavior.
So I'm going to move on to a drug policy question for you.
Okay.
So if you were given a golden ticket for one drug policy to be implemented immediately, what would you choose and why?
Well, I would regulate all drugs. That would be a painfully complicated golden ticket to cash in. And I'll tell you why. You know, at the most basic way of saying this is that, consider our current regime. which is largely a system of criminalization. We have a small number of drugs that are regulated. And what's really interesting about those small number of drugs that are regulated is that they are regulated in widely divergent ways. So lots of people say, are opioids illegal in Canada? Well, yes, they are. But also, they're regulated. There's heroin prescription that's available in Canada, in principle. What is heroin prescription? Well, it's this managed opioid use thing where people who are opioid dependent are able to use heroin, pure prescription, pharmaceutical grade heroin, sort of on a managed basis through medical supervision and medical dosage. And we've seen that it's a really effective way for people who have failed other forms of medication-assisted treatment to manage their use. Now, that looks nothing like our system of alcohol regulation. And a system of alcohol regulation is going to look very different from the way cannabis is regulated across the country. And none of those look anything like tobacco regulation. So what I'm trying to get at here is that the process of regulating drugs is extremely complicated, but it's also quite effective. Or at the very least, it provides policymakers with lots and lots of flexibility to address range of harms that potentially can pop up. Now compare this wildly divergent system of regulation for all these different substances to the way that we deal with street heroin or cocaine or MDMA or like name any other legal drug. It is identical. They are all identical. And yet all of those drugs are as distinct from each other as alcohol is from tobacco, is from cannabis. And in some ways, it is entirely predictable that the bluntest, broadest instrument available, which is the criminalization of drugs, is associated with the worst outcomes. As in, it doesn't stop people from using, and it just takes drug use that could be safer and makes it more dangerous. Now, if we can set up a system of regulation that is distinct for each of those currently illegal drugs, and get a sense of how those all work in tandem, because as we know, it's not like the market for regulated cannabis is going to be totally independent of the market for regulated alcohol. Those two markets are going to have impacts on each other, as those markets are going to have an impact on regulated tobacco. If we can understand how all these markets operate and how they influence each other, and then we can use the very refined and flexible tools of regulation to adapt those systems as necessary to ensure that while we don't end drug use, because that is an unrealistic goal, what we can do is, as has been shown over time, we can incentivize less harmful drug use, like the use of drugs that are less harmful, and less harmful forms of use. That would be my golden ticket. It would be the work of many lifetimes, but I think it's not a totally unrealistic goal at this point, at least in Canada, and one that we should strive for.
Yeah. Do you have hope that in our lifetime that it will happen?
Yes, I do.
In which case, that's a very positive way to end. We will end. But no, thank you so much, Dan, for this interview.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Yeah.
Catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.